Well, it's spring break time, and I know not because I have a daughter who's home all week, which she is, but because we took last week off. That's right, there's no England, and there were no guests, and there was no program, Ira. So, Ian, where did you go last week?
I took a very responsible adult trip to Las Vegas to check out the scenery. So, like I said, I was very responsible. I came out ahead, and we'll just leave it at that.
Nice. Ira, a responsible adult trip to Las Vegas. That sounds like a contradiction of terms, doesn't it?
You know, check out the scenery. The first thing I don't think of was a casino. That's not the first thing I think of. But, you know, to each their own.
Oh, anyway, now we're back. And Ira, I've been reading your posts online. I get the feeling that we're not going to be talking much about Tom Brady and the Bucs this year, correct?
No, we had some news yesterday. I guess Devin White's agent made a couple of calls.
Right.
Where else? Adam Schefter. Take it from there. My client's not happy. He wants to be paid. Clark, it's the same old story. It doesn't happen with the Bucs very often. Not very often. But, you know, he's looking around and he sees Roquan Smith, you know, getting paid and different Bucks getting paid. And frankly, I don't think the Bucks are doing anything wrong. Clark, they want to see more.
Yeah.
And
he doesn't see Tom Brady at quarterback either.
Yeah. You know, things, once Brady leaves town, Clark, they tend to fall apart a little bit.
Well, I asked you about this before, but I'll ask you again. How different is the mood in that area without Brady there to energize the fans?
Well, I mean, all of a sudden, you know, the Rays are on the front pages of the sports section.
Should
the
be.
Lightning
Should
are
be.
Gearing up, you know, to play Toronto in the first round and maybe down the line Boston. Clark, it wouldn't take much for the Bucks to fall out of favor here. You know, it's a football town. We understand that. But, you know, they go 6-11. There's going to be a lot of empty seats at that stadium.
Are we going to be putting you on the Rays beat this year?
I've done baseball time and again. It's the toughest beat to fill. You know that.
It is brutal. 162 games. Well, as I hope you know at home, this is a Hall of Fame theme show. So when I was approached not that long ago by Toby Christensen, who is the son of former Raiders great Todd Christensen, to ask about his dad and why no action on the Canton radar, I thought, you know what, why not? Let's get him on here. I covered the Chargers for 10 years. I covered him in the 1980s, early 1990s. I saw Todd Christensen. I saw him twice a year. He was a Hall of Fame worthy player, a great tight end. He was on two Super Bowl champions, five-time All-Pro, five-time Pro Bowler, twice led the league in catches. And he was the first tight end to have 90 receptions in a season. He did that twice, Ira. So essentially, he did virtually everything but get into Canton. And I know that meant a lot to him. And the reason I know is because his son, that would be Toby Christensen, once said it. And Toby, he's here with us. Thanks for joining us. And please, if you can, tell me what's harder for you to understand, that your dad's not in Canton or that he hasn't even been a Hall of Fame semifinalist?
I guess both. I mean, just the fact that he's been so overlooked and almost forgotten for so long is definitely tough to take, you know, as the bias. And I think he was outstanding. If you give me a chance to, you know, defend him and give you some of the reasons why I think he belongs, you know, in that group of those great tight ends that are already in Canton, you know, you'll see why I think it's so strange that he's been overlooked for so long.
Well, the floor is yours. Go ahead. Take it away.
All right. Well, just stop me if you need to. But, you know, the first thing I like to point to, you know, so my father played from 78 to 88. The best comparator for my father would probably be Kellen Winslow. And just before I get started, if I ever bring up another tight end or another player in a comparative role, it doesn't mean any disrespect to that player at all. I mean, I think the three best comparators for my old man would be Kellen Winslow, Ozzie Newsome, and Dave Casper, three guys that are in the Hall of Fame, three guys that are phenomenal players. And if I say anything, I don't want it to sound like I'm taking anything away from those three guys as I push my father's agenda here. But to start with, Kellen Winslow is widely viewed. I think if you ask the average football fan and even most of the smart football fans, if you said who's the greatest tight end of the pre-Shannon Sharp, Tony Gonzalez era, the 70s and 80s, I think you know, you're going to get the answer Kellen Winslow from the majority of people. So I like starting with Kellen Winslow because he's considered the standard for the time. And as someone who covered the Chargers, you're very well aware of his career as well as his talents. I mean, he was a phenomenal football player, no doubt about it. Now, the thing that's interesting that people don't realize is here you have Kellen Winslow, who's widely considered the greatest tight end of that era, the greatest tight end before the Sharp Gonzalez time, maybe even the greatest tight end of all time. And yet he played at the exact same time as my father. And if you compare the numbers between them, if you look at career numbers, Kellen Winslow had 80 catches more than my father. I want to say it was about 800 yards more and 4 touchdowns. That's about one average season, 8,804. That's the only thing positively separating Winslow from my father. Now you go into the rest of the stuff. They both had 5 Pro Bowls. They both had 4 All Pros. My father was 2-time first team, 2-time second team AP, but he was also a 3rd-time first team with NEA, which was a big deal back then because that was the players' vote. It was a big deal because that was the players' All Pro. So essentially, he was 3-time first team, just like Winslow was. So you've got, they're even with the All Pros, they're even with the Pro Bowls. Winslow's career stats are slightly better, but then you get into some of the other things, like, I mean, obviously championships. My father had 2 Super Bowl rings. Winslow didn't have any. My father played in 11 playoff games. Winslow played in 6 playoff games. My father blocked for a league-leading rusher in Marcus Allen. Winslow never did that. You know, so there's a lot of things like that. And then you mentioned it before, too. He was groundbreaking for the time. My father was the first tight end to lead, to have 90 receptions. He led the league in receiving twice. The only other tight end at the time that had done that was Kellen Winslow, not Dave Casper. Ozzie Newsome never did it. You know, for a 6-year stretch, he was inarguably the very best tight end in the NFL. According to, what was the name of the site? It was Ainsworth Sports, which was similar to Pro Football Focus back then. They ranked him as the number one tight end for the season 4 times in the 80s, Winslow 3 times, and Newsome was never ranked number one in the 80s. And so when you see that, you think, okay, so for this 6-year stretch, this guy was the very best tight end. He was groundbreaking. He did things nobody had done before, and really nobody did until Sharp and Gonzalez kind of changed things. I mean, one was a converted receiver and the other one was a converted power forward. That's when we first started changing these tight ends into these unbelievable athletes that they are today. And so as you look at those numbers, it's hard for me to think that, oh, Kellen Winslow is a surefire Hall of Famer. But then you look at my father, whose numbers are very comparable and better in a lot of areas, and you say, why has he been overlooked and not even considered? You know, and some people think it might be, you know, for a while I heard it was the Raider bias. And for a while I heard it was because maybe my father was a little bit arrogant back in those days. And maybe he rubbed some people the wrong way. I'm not sure, but I would like to know. And I waited a while to start pushing this because I honestly felt like Cliff Branch was just as deserving, if not more, than my father. And as a Raider fan and as a Raider person, you know, I felt like I wanted to wait and see Cliff Branch get in before I kind of started pushing for my father's, you know, his memory to be brought up again and his career to be brought up so that he could have his, you know, like, I think it's deserving his spot in Canton. And so I waited. And now I feel like, you know what, now is the time. That's why I reached out to you, reached out to a few other voters and said, talk to me, what's going on? Why has he been overlooked? So anyway, that's the comparison with Winslow. I feel like as I do that comparison with Dave Casper, it makes his argument even stronger. And people think of Dave Casper as being like the generation before or that era before. But the truth was he was only 4 years before my father. It wasn't like there was this massive difference between them. So, you know, I'm obviously biased. I don't know if you want me to keep going with the comparison between Casper and my father, if you want me to keep going with Winslow or Newsome. If you want me to answer any questions, but I do feel like, you know, his body of work is, I mean, after everything I told you, my father had 4 seasons better than Casper's best season, statistically speaking. I mean, to me, that's crazy. 4 seasons better. And Ozzie Newsome's best season, my father had 2 seasons better than Ozzie Newsome's best season, statistically. And Ozzie Newsome played in what, 3, you know, he played in a handful of playoff games. But he didn't have a ring. Winslow didn't have a ring. So, you know, I get a little defensive. And like I said, this is no disrespect to these great players at all. I'm just trying to show you that this isn't a case of me saying he was almost as good here or almost as good here. He was flat out better in so many areas. but he's been overlooked for so long, and I'm trying to remedy that.
Yeah, I would think, Toby, if you contacted us in 2017 at this time, Ira might agree with this. We'd say his longevity. But then we put in Terrell Davis, we put in Kenny Easley, and then more recently we put in Tony Baselli. So longevity doesn't count. I mean, your dad started 90 games, and I realized what the deal was between injuries and special teams. He played little offense the first 4 years. So he essentially had 5.5 seasons, but he had 5.5 great seasons. And that counted for less than that, actually, kind of for Terrell Davis. So I will be honest with you, and Ira, you can take it away from here. I'm a little bit mystified why he hasn't gotten at least traction. And Ira, we talk about that, at least getting in the room. I don't know why he hasn't gotten traction.
Absolutely. Toby, I'll tell you right now why Dave Casper's wearing has a bust in Canton. Toby, the 1977 postseason, he scored 5 touchdowns on national television. And
he was great, no doubt about it. No doubt about it.
That's the reason. That's the reason. And your father played in the 84 Super Bowl and caught 4 balls, but he wasn't the star of the game. And nobody was talking about Todd Christensen winning the game. They're talking about Jack Squirek and Marcus Allen and whatever. So that's what happens. You know, Toby, I didn't know that much about your dad. I started watching the films, the old films. You know, he reminds me of Travis Kelce. Kelce.
He gets that a lot.
He's not a speed burner. I don't know what his time was in the 40. It was decent, but it wasn't great.
His story was the Raiders gave him number 46 because he ran a 4.6. I don't know if that's a true story or not.
I don't know.
But he used to tell me that story.
Sounds good.
Here's my question. So, talk about what he used to tell you about fitting in, Toby, a guy that's really religious, an intellectual, sprouting poetry. And, Toby, he joins a franchise that is known for renegades, guys that kick around with other teams. They come to the Raiders. They do their thing. How did he flourish in the locker room? How did he gain everybody's respect when, Toby, to be honest, he was different. He was different.
He was very different. No doubt about it. You know, I think the reason it was so easy for him to get along with other guys was because he was just true to himself, and he didn't try to change, you know, to be depending on who he was with. I mean, he was always honest with who he was. He wasn't ashamed of it. I mean, the guy definitely, as you guys know, didn't lack for confidence. There were no insecurities about him. And so he was who he was. And I mean, he became great friends with Marcus Allen and Matt Millen and some of these guys. I mean, he and Marcus Allen walked out, you know, before every game together. It was their tradition. And he was, you know, a little bit probably too loud, which happened to him a lot of times in his life when, you know, the Raiders kind of went with Bo Jackson over Marcus Allen because he and Marcus had grown so close and he'd seen Marcus, you know, play through injuries and you know, and he was loyal to his friends and he was a good friend of these guys. And so it was an interesting dynamic having this pseudo-intellectual religious guy quoting poetry, writing his own poetry, actually, not just quoting poetry, you know, with the likes of Lyle Alzado and you know, some of these guys, some of these characters, Lester Hayes, you know, and some of the characters on the Raiders back in that time. I mean, rumor has it, I don't even think it's a rumor anymore, Ted Hendricks couldn't stand him. You know, and in fact, in the Super Bowl speech afterwards, for whatever reason, my father was one of the last guys to stand up and give his little speech. And Hendricks was like, sit down, you Mormon, you know. And so anyway, it was fun times. But I think just being true to who he was really helped him. And he was he loved the other guys. He loved, you know, picking their brains about, you know, what they did in the offseason to work out, what they did to stay in tip top shape, what they did to, you know, just to better themselves. And he was, you know, even though he came across as arrogant, he never thought he was better than anybody else. But he was very confident in himself, if that makes sense.
Well, you know, Ira, something you may not understand or know is that he never played with a Hall of Fame quarterback, nor did he play with anyone that went to a Pro Bowl. I mean, you look at the quarterbacks he played with, And they were kind of dead flat average, to be honest with you. I mean, I know, you know, Jim Plunkett won a couple of Super Bowls, but he's not on the Hall of Fame list either. But Toby,
Mark Wilson was the other one.
Mark Wilson, yeah. But I know the other thing, Ira, that Toby's mentioned in the past. I think there's something to this, that he believes that wanderlust of the Raiders probably hurt his dad. And I think it probably did too, or does, because there's really no local media to support him. I mean, the LA media, they're not supporting him. They're gone. The Oakland media, they're not supporting him. They're gone. Las Vegas media, they never saw him. So I think there's something to that. And Toby, you can address that, but I think you're onto something there because, you know, when we are pushing people, Ira has pushed Tampa Bay Bucks literally for the last, what, Ira, 11, 12 years straight. Yeah. And he's gotten four of them in there. And so you get energized and passionate about the people you cover. But if you haven't covered them or they're gone, you're no longer passionate.
No, you're right. And that's what I've heard. You know, obviously you guys know a lot more about what goes on behind those closed doors. And I've just started to learn a little bit. There's been a few of the other of your colleagues, the other voters who have filled me in on this. And they've been more than, I mean, all of the ones I've talked to have been super kind. You guys are a great group and I appreciate you. Ron Borges, you know, was explaining to me everything that goes on. And it seems like over the past little while, there's been a remedy to that lack of Raiders in the Hall of Fame is you got in Ray Guy and you got in Kent Stabler and you got in Cliff Branch and Tom Flores, which in a way I hope doesn't hurt my father's chances because you guys are like, hey, we're a little tired of Raiders for the time being. Yeah. He might need a year or two before we start really getting serious about him. And if that's the case, it is the case. But I would hope that isn't the case. I don't think this is an all-star game where you're like, oh, we need one guy from the Royals and we need one guy from the Rays just to make sure it's fair. This is the Hall of Fame. If he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame more than anybody else that's out there, and his stats compared to the Dave Casper, who played with a Hall of Fame quarterback, Kellen Winslow, who played with a Hall of Fame quarterback, you know, let's get him in there. It doesn't matter that we got Cliff Branson and Tom Flores. He deserves to be in there. Just because we put 1,000 Steelers in right away and waited on those 70s Raiders doesn't mean that should affect Todd Christensen. You know, and so that's kind of my feeling. But you're right about the media. I've had other people outside of, you know, your organization tell me that it can't help him to not have media going to bat for him like you guys do for your teams. And, you know, I reached out to the Vegas gentleman and he said exactly what you just said. He said, hey, Toby, I've been pushing, you know, he goes, I'm going to bring him up. But he goes, it might have to take a while because we just got some Raiders in recently. But you know, he was very kind and thank me for, you know, all the research that I've been doing on this.
Well, I worked with Ron for years with the Talk of Fame Network. I know how passionate he is about the Raiders team he covered and about Todd Christensen in particular. But
he wrote an article about 6 years ago about my father and why he hadn't been elected. And it was nice to see, you know, I as I've Googled this, there's probably been about 5 or 6 articles written over time about people wondering why he hasn't been, you know, inducted. And one was by Mr. Borges.
Yeah. No, and Ira and I have known him for years. And as I said, I worked with him on the Talk of Fame Network. In fact, that was our site that post appeared on. But I do think you mentioned this, and Ira, you can weigh on it. There's Raider fatigue that comes in. And that's what you alluded to, Toby. And I understand what you're saying, but at some point, some people, and I know some people in particular on that board have said, how many Raiders are we going to put in? We putting in Lester Hayes? We putting in Jack Tatum? We putting them all in? How many are we going to put in? And I think that's a factor too. And you can say it's not fair, but I think it's real.
It's not fair, Clark, because the Raiders were a fantastic, successful organization. You know, from the mid-60s to like 1990. I mean, you know, very few franchises won more games than the Raiders. They had stars every way you look. And I'm with Toby on this one. Cliff Branch getting in should have no bearing, no bearing at all on Todd Christensen. Clark, I got a quick question for our guest today. Toby, tell me a little bit about his reluctance to play tight end with Dallas and even the Giants. And all of a sudden, Al Davis says, hey, you want to try tight end? And he says, I'm all for it. What was going on there?
Well, what happened was is he grew up just the absolute biggest fan of Jim Brown. He wanted to be Jim Brown, and everything he did, his training, he just wanted to be the next Jim Brown. So he goes to BYU as a running back. He plays fullback but leads the team in receiving out of the backfield 3 straight years. So obviously he looks like a tight end. It was funny because he's one of those few people that actually lied about their heights the opposite way. He was actually just a shade under 6'4", but always told people 6'2". By the time he got to the NFL, it was 6'3". But I mean, on any given day, he was actually 6'4", but they did not want 6'4" running backs, right? And so he was, he just wanted to be a running back. And I think when he got to the Cowboys, he was still a little full of himself and thought he could be an NFL running back. He didn't want to change. He was a second round pick. He was supposed to be the guy, but after being cut by the Cowboys, being cut by the Giants, I'm sure it humbled him. And he was like, you put me anywhere on the field, I just want to play. And I think it took, you know, those two setbacks for him to kind of humble himself and say, listen, I just want an opportunity. And a lot of people don't even realize this either, that, I mean, he was the long snapper from 79 till about 84, 85, until they got Trey Junkin. I mean, he was doing double duty. He led the league in receiving, wins a Super Bowl ring, and he's the long snapper for Hall of Fame punter Ray Guy. I mean, that's unheard of now. Can you imagine Travis Kelce being your long snapper?
Not too shabby. Hey, no. Toby, talk a little bit about how disheartening it ended in 89. Bad feelings with Shanahan. I'm curious about Al Davis. How did it end with your father and Al Davis in 89? Were they on bad terms from that point on?
Obviously our family aren't, you know, we're not huge fans of Mike Shanahan. I mean, he came in and he kind of cleaned house. It wasn't just my father. There's a few old Raiders that have been, you know, around for those Super Bowl teams that he just kind of cleaned house and did his thing. And there was no love lost between my father and Shanahan. Anytime we'd say anything about Al Davis that was, slightly negative at all, he'd say, don't talk bad about the man that paid the bills for a long time. And so he, even though he may not have been Al Davis's biggest fan, he definitely respected the man and was grateful to him because he understood that the last 10 years of his career, he owed to Al Davis. And so there wasn't a ton of love, you know, there wasn't a ton of animosity towards Al Davis. There was more towards Mike Shanahan, who made that decision. But at the time, he still had multiple teams calling, wanting to give him an opportunity. We wanted him to keep playing, but NBC came with this big offer, and he said, I'm just going to go broadcast football games for NBC. And then a lot of people don't know, he actually had a major league tryout with the Oakland A's and the Los Angeles Dodgers, and was told that they'd put him in Double-A right then. But he goes, nah, if you don't think I'm good enough to play in the bigs, I don't want to. But he had a major league tryout as a 32-year-old at Dodger Stadium, and Oakland A's and Los Angeles Dodger scouts were there, and he did great. Well, from what he told me, I wasn't there. Of course, my dad's going to tell me that.
What position?
He was a right fielder in high school. I think he was drafted out of high school by the Indians or something, like some super long round, like 40th round or something like that. But he loved baseball and thought it would take less off his body.
We're speaking with Toby Christensen, the son of former Raiders great Todd Christensen, on the Eye Test for Two. And Toby, what's your fondest memory of your dad?
Fondest memory of my father, man. He was such, I mean, if we were talking about Hall of Fame for dads, he'd already be in. He was a very present father, always there teaching us. I mean, the two biggest things he taught us. And so when you say fondest memory, if you're talking about one experience, I mean, it's tough for me to come up with one experience. But when I think of him, the two biggest things he always taught us were hard work and gratitude. And those have been like etched in my mind forever. Now, my kids are like probably tired of hearing about it because it's like hard work, be grateful. Hard work, be grateful. You don't deserve anything. You know, you got to work for whatever you get. And those two things, you know, are seared into my brain because of him. And he, he wasn't lavish with his praise. I mean, I still remember a basketball game where I scored 22 points in high school, and I was thrilled after the game. And he goes, but you reached with two fouls and got your third foul, and you hurt your team. He expected perfection to reach for the stars and be the best version of ourselves we could be. And he pushed us to do that. And not only did he push us to do that, but he was there as a resource whenever we needed.
When I opened this, it read a litany of his accomplishments, you know, Pro Bowls, all pros, leading the league in receptions, all that stuff. And I'm just wondering, from your vantage point, what was your dad's greatest accomplishment, or what do you think he considered his greatest accomplishment as a football player?
Oh, easy. He was a writer. And after he passed away, it's emotional thinking about it, but reading his entry in the 84 Super Bowl, he was at the top of the profession. He led the league in receiving. He was the best tight end in the league. He was first team all pro. He broke records, and he was on the championship team that won the Super Bowl. I mean, he couldn't have done more that season. You know, I mean, it really was at the time. I don't think the league's leading receiver had ever won the Super Bowl as well. And in fact, some weird stat he used to tell me, and I'm not exactly sure on that one, but you know, that was his greatest football accomplishment.
Well, he taught you about hard work and gratitude. What was he grateful for?
He was grateful for his opportunities. He was grateful for his parents. He was grateful for his family. He was grateful for his friends. I mean, he just never took anything for granted. You know, like you guys putting me on the show, you know, I've learned to say, like, I don't expect anything. You guys are great for having me on the show. And that's something that I learned from him. You know, this is an opportunity that you're giving me, and I'm grateful for it. And that was just kind of the way he was. He just, if someone had him on, you know, up close with Roy Firestone, he'd say, thank you for having me. Even though he was doing Roy a favor, he'd say, thank you for having me. And I still remember, like, I got myself in a jam right before the bubble burst, you know, with the market and everything, and tried to flip a home. And it's a long, boring story. Anyway, long story short, I lost, and I went to him. You know, it was embarrassing to ask for help. He loaned me some money to help me out. And as I started to pay him back, every time I paid him back, he said, thank you. And I finally stopped him and I said, Dad, why are you thanking me for paying you back the money that you bailed me out with? And he goes, because I don't take that for granted. I've loaned a lot of people money over the years, and not all of them have paid me back. And it was just such a big lesson to me. So anyway, I've just, you know, just always been appreciative for his example.
Last one for me, Todd. Thanks so much for your time. Todd, they throw around this term renaissance man. Well, I'm going to tell you who's a renaissance man. Your father with 3 books of poetry. I think he sang opera. He was a tenor. Tell me if I'm wrong. And this one I had to look at twice because I just couldn't believe it. The top decathlete in the world, age 45 or over. In the world. I mean, that is one hell of a renaissance man, Todd.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. We'd laugh about all of the stuff he was doing, you know, after the age of 40, because, you know, how many 45-year-olds, you know, that are out there running hurdles and doing shot put, and you're like, Dad, give it a rest. But he loved it, man, and he was a great athlete. In fact, when he had his liver issues, the doctor said, this is by far the healthiest liver transplant patient we've ever had. We've never seen anything like this. He just unfortunately had a bad liver. But he did so many things, and, you know, he passed away young at 57, but the things he accomplished in the short 57 years of life are, you know, tough to compare to.
Did he sing around the house, Todd?
All the time. I mean, he embarrassed us. You know, sometimes at church they hit that high note and most of the people just kind of let it go. And he'd hit that high note and we'd like duck behind the pew. Like, we didn't want anyone to see us as kids, because he was just, I mean, you could Google Todd Christensen singing the national anthem, because his partner at one of the networks filmed him, because he did the same thing before a ball game. He would just start singing that national anthem and he'd stand up and belt it out and didn't care who heard him. So yes, to answer your question, he sang around the house and other places as well.
That happens around my house when I start singing, but not the national anthem when I try to carry a tune, because I can't sing at all. My daughter goes running for cover too. Toby Christensen, thanks so much for the time, and good luck pushing your dad's candidacy. I think Ira and I have learned a lot today, and at the very least, he's deserving of a conversation. So thank you very much, and keep on pushing.
Oh, I appreciate it. I will. I'll bug you. If you guys don't get him in this year, I'll bug you again next year to get on your show again.
Look forward to it. Toby, thanks so much.
Thanks, you guys.
Toby Christensen, son of former Raider star Todd Christensen. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, you know, you can say whether he's, you know, worthy of the Hall of Fame or not. He's at least worthy of being a semifinalist, and he's never been one. And you look at that body of work, he's got a point. I mean, I covered Kellen Winslow. Kellen Winslow was the second greatest athlete on the ever covered. That was Jerry Rice talking about guys I covered daily basis. But Todd Christensen was a lethal weapon for those 5-6 years when he was playing. And I realize that's a small window, but we've elected guys in smaller windows than that. So longevity can't be an issue.
You know, Clark, they talk about peak value. Peak value.
Yeah, right.
For a player like Mickey Mantle, you know, from 55 to 61 or something.
Right.
You're right. The window was rather short. But man, at the time, at the peak, he was the best tight end in football. And
he
was for more than 1 year. That's
right. He was the best tight end in football.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm hearing some crowd cheering. Where are you? What are you doing?
Well, I'm going back in that time machine again. I'm going back since the draft is coming up to the draft process just in general. I mean, the years that I was covering the Chargers, actually, 1 year, this shows you how bad it was. Ian would go, what are you talking about? I was covering the Baltimore, not Indianapolis, Baltimore Colts when they drafted John Elway. But and then she was covering the 49ers. But I have to laugh, Ira, today at the secrecy of the draft process. You know, it's like everything's behind closed doors, lock and key and everything. And how different it was when you and I covered teams on a daily basis. Now, I saw something Peter King wrote this week, how in 1984, his first year on the beat with, I think it was the Enquirer in Cincinnati, he goes into Sam Weish's office and Sam Weish says to him, you want to know who we're going to draft? Now, Ian, if you hear a coach ask you that, you go, okay, what's the punchline? Yep, no, he said, you want to know? And he goes, yeah, as long as you don't share it with anyone, here it is. So he gives him three guys. I think Boomer Esiason was one of them. Goes down, Dave Lapham was another one. First round draft picks. They took them all. They took them all. He didn't lie. They took them all. And then I go fast forward 12 years when I was at the scouting combine in Indianapolis. And Butch Hobson, who's now a Hall of Fame voter, he was then working in Cincinnati. Maybe they're just more honest in Cincinnati or trusting whatever, but he's covering the team in Cincinnati. And he's at the scouting combine along with me and maybe like seven other guys that really weren't many people. And he says to me, here's the guy the Bengals are going to take. I said, this guy? And he goes, yeah. It was Auburn tackle Willie Anderson. They took him with the 10th pick that year. He told me in February they were going to take him. Clearly, someone had tipped him off. You ever had anything like that, Ira?
It happened once, Clark, and it wasn't that long ago. It was at the Arizona Biltmore, an owner's meeting, and it was like the 2018 draft, and our producer Ian will know what I'm talking about because I was out there and I ran into Dirk Cutter, who was in his, I think his final year as a Buck coach that season, 2018. And, you know, he had a cocktail in his hand and I sidled up to him and we started talking about the draft. It was about a month before the draft.
Did you keep pouring that cocktail, Ira? Did you keep pouring that cocktail?
I had a ginger ale. I had a ginger ale.
And, I mean, for him.
So I didn't expect any kind of, you know, insight. And I said, hey, what are you thinking about? You know, I think they had the 19th pick. Ironically, they have the 19th pick this month. So Cutter looks at me and he puts his drink down. He goes, I'll tell you one thing, Ira. If that kid, O.J. Howard's there at 19, we're taking him. We're taking him. I never wrote it, of course. But if I, you know, when I went on talk shows or podcasts, I would say like, hey, don't forget about this guy, O.J. Howard. He's a possibility. He's a possibility. That's the way you can look good.
Yeah,
you
know, that's right.
It turns out to be right. And Ian, at 19, they took O.J. Howard right before the Vikings took Dalvin Cook. Right before Dalvin Cook. You remember that, don't you, Mr. Glendon?
I remember everything.
That's because he's a lot closer to 19 than you and I are, if you know what I mean.
Ian the Clark. Ian's hoping that the Bucks do a little better with the 19th pick this year. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, this is going to be a, you were talking about it earlier in the show. This is going to be a very long season for the Buccaneers. And they might be able to pull out a few with some Baker type magic, but six wins might be the be optimistic.
Well, that'd be good. That might win the division.
Well, you know, Clark, it could put him in a position to draft a quarterback next year, which I think might be a better draft for quarterbacks.
No, I agree with you. All right, you got any final thoughts for this week?
Final thoughts. Well, Devin White shook up Buck Nation, Clark. And I'm curious, you know, you've covered this game a long time. How many times have you been involved with a player that demanded to be traded. You got a call from an agent.
Too many. Yeah. And I was like the guy who's going to sit out the season. You go, right. All right. Let's wait until October. All right. When,
you know, he might not show up for the first day of training. That's about as far as it'll go.
But you know, it's funny, Ira, when I was covering the Chargers in the early mid to late 80s and then early 90s, I remember someone on the desk there saying, we don't need to write about contract negotiations so much. But you're within that bubble. You think this is a big deal. You know, Devin, it's a big deal. After a while, you realize as time goes on, no, it's not. It's just a blip on the radar. Everyone's sort of playing a game. And then when it's over, you say, well, I thought you said this. Oh, yeah. No, we didn't mean it. Well, I trusted you. It's kind of like, you know, Animal House. I trusted you. That was your mistake. Anyway, I want to mention Dick Vermeil, who's a Hall of Fame coach and also friend of the show. Last week, he said, we need more coaches in Canton. And he suggested two per year, one living and one deceased. Sorry, Ira, sorry. That is not going to happen. I mean, there's just not that many deserving. Plus, I mean, you just really don't want to see this process watered down. It's the Hall of Fame, not the Hall of Very Good. And I hope you agree with me. I don't know what your thoughts are, and I also don't know what Ian's thoughts are, but I'd be interested in hearing them.
I'm right there with you, Clark. It's like people are saying, well, you got to put a contributor in every year. Clark, there's not a list of 35 contributors. I mean, let's be honest. You know, we're not talking about Randy Gratishar, you know, trying to get a gold jacket.
No, that's right. And the reason we put the two together, coaches and contributors, was there weren't that many of either.
Right. That's right. I'm happy with the current system, and I hope that that this three senior thing, Clark, has a long run and it doesn't end in a year or two.
Yeah, I agree. Ian, you got any thoughts on the coaches?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you you're going to be hard pressed to find, like, a lot of coaches' success obviously is centered around winning and Super Bowls, and there's only so many Super Bowls that have been won in this league. So how many real Hall of Fame worthy coaches are there? And like you said, the list is pretty short, and at a certain point very soon you're just going to be putting someone in to put someone in, and that's not what the Hall of Fame is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Anyway, that's going to do it. If you'd like to listen to this or any iTestFor2 podcast, just go to our website, iTestFor2.com, or you go to Ian's website, which is FullPressCoverage.com. And you know what? You could vote for us, put us in the Hall of Fame. We're on both places, iTestFor2 and FullPressCoverage.com. And if you can't make it then, let's just come back next week, because we're going to be here at, where is that?
The iTestFor2 with another provocative guest.
Absolutely. Keep it under wraps there, Ira. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.